Hello, this is Chris, and welcome to Foundations in Social Innovation. This podcast is recorded on unceded Kaurna land. I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future, and to the traditional custodians of the land on which you're listening today.
The story of our communities, people and nation starts a long, long time ago. More than 60,000 years, in fact. This was when our culture and our law first started to thrive. We knew who we were and where we belonged. We took care of each other, our land and our waters. We ate food that made us healthy, lived on country and abided by our laws and song lines. Our families, our children were happy with strong minds and hearts because they were where they belonged. But then, everything changed.
Colonization came, bringing wars, disease, famine, violence, and the destruction and violation of our cultural laws, sacred sites, families, and communities.
We were denied our knowledge, language, ceremonies, and identity. The very things that tell us who we are and where we belong. And our connections with each other and the land grew weak.
And then our children were taken from us. They had their names changed and their identities stripped away. They were told that Aboriginal people were bad. Worse still, they were told that their parents and grandparents did not want them.
For years this happened, and those children became known as the Stolen Generations.
Our children were denied love and experienced physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. This left very deep, very complex, and very real wounds, leaving scars that are still being felt personally, socially, spiritually, and collectively.
In the time when our story started, we were able to parent in the cultural way that has seen our families survive and thrive for generations. Our people were strong, and our culture flowed and healed us in times of hurt.
But since the trauma of colonization and the Stolen Generations, we have not been able to heal in the same way. And we have unknowingly passed this trauma on to our children through sharing our sad stories and having them witness and experience our pain. This is known as intergenerational trauma, and we see symptoms today in broken relationships, disconnected families, violence, suicide, and drug and alcohol abuse.
But this is not where our story ends. We still have strong minds and hearts, and we still know who we were and where we belong. By creating safe and strong communities together, supporting our families to be free from pain, returning to our culture and building a strength of identity, we can stop the cycle of trauma and bring about positive intergenerational change so that we can continue to thrive for the next 60,000 years. There are simple things that we can all do to help heal our trauma.
Visit healingfoundation.org.au to find out more.
That's the audio from a video created by the Healing Foundation and a short video that Oni Vicky plays as part of our cultural inductions at TACSI, and I wanted to share that with you here. And this episode is another recap episode. We are threading some threads together and some threads that have run all the way through Finzi in this case. We're looking at what we've learnt about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander ways of being and doing and thinking and revisiting some of the Aboriginal innovators and thinkers that we've heard from along this journey. And you might want to reflect as you're listening to this on what you've taken away about the ways in which you as a social innovator can further self-determination and further Aboriginal ways of knowing and being and doing and support reconciliation or conciliation. But before we get to the recap, I just wanted to frame this episode with, again, from a recent cultural induction, but a few taxi folks reading our leadership statement, which guides how we are working toward reconciliation at Taxi. And hearing it again in that cultural induction, I think it does a very good job of bringing together everything that we're trying to do.
So it'll be Pippa, Siobhan, Tasman, Brew, Anne and Lauren. And Anne, Lauren. And so if you can just, because this is part of our statement and commitment to reconciliation and furthering Aboriginal knowledge, wisdom and self-determination. So Pip, take it away.
So the Australian Centre for Social Innovation is committed to furthering self-determination through Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander-led innovation.
We believe it is unacceptable that systems designed to support people maintain the ongoing impacts of colonisation and intergenerational trauma. We have a responsibility to be part of this change.
Standing our commitment, we respect that we, Taxi, as individuals, and as a whole, have a lot to learn about how to further self-determination. Each step must begin with acknowledging the true history of harm done to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities.
In our choices, we seek to learn the many ways to let go of power. And as we go, building deep, authentic and meaningful partnerships with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, organisations and communities is a critical part of this journey as well.
Walking together with compassion, we seek to learn from and build on over 70,000 years of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, as to Torres Strait Islander experience and wisdom.
Without having all the answers, we are moving forward. We have the conviction that disrupting disadvantage, reaching the heart of intergenerational trauma and furthering self-determination is achieved by inspiring, influencing and unlocking the potential people hold. We will achieve this by building our connection and our responsibility to one another.
In the module that asked what is social innovation, we explored what social innovation is in Australia today for a number of Aboriginal social innovators. And this gave us a bit of a flavour of the breadth of Aboriginal-led social innovations.
We say that this dialogue process is unprecedented in Australian history. There's never been such a process that has involved convened for and hosted by First Nations people on constitutional reform.
We heard from Professor Megan Davis on a project that we've looked at a number of times through FINSE, the participatory process that led to the creation of the Uluru Statement of the Heart, which itself calls for greater Aboriginal representation and participation in decision making.
My work then has kind of been very focused on a nation building approach to what was going on in my particular community. And one of the responses to the whole Kumarang issue was that we were not very well organised as a Ngarrindjeri community to respond quickly and effectively to the challenges that were put before us at that point in time. And in part, that was a product of the history of the way things had developed in South Australia, but I would think actually across the country, most of the organisations...
From Daryl Rigney, an Wurundjeri man and a former taxi board member, we heard about the concept of nation building and how he'd been supporting with his peers the organisation of the Wurundjeri nation to break free of government funding and to fight for a number of cultural rights in terms of developments or getting back the bones of their old people from overseas. We heard about the work that we'd done supporting AMIAC and in part learning from Indigenous nations internationally, and this was a big theme of Daryl's learning as well, learning from Indigenous nations overseas as to how they had organised and their innovations.
Young Aboriginal offenders are 28 times more likely than non-Indigenous youth to end up in juvenile detention. Now a new program is hoping to change that. The state's first Koori Court will begin hearing cases in Western Sydney in the new year. Alan Clark.
We heard a little about the Koori Court and a new kind of Aboriginal-specific response that it's getting better outcomes for Aboriginal people. And from Dana Shen, we heard about the concept of Noongar streaming, the idea that actually if we design things that work for Aboriginal people and Aboriginal families, that actually they'll work for lots of other people too. And this could be a way to create new kinds of universal services and supports.
So a different scenario. So this is what I read out to people in professional stakeholder workshops, asked people to close their eyes, and lots of Aboriginal people were involved in this. This is a system that was built by us from the ground up for our people. It closed the gap some time ago. Actually, the rest of the community are starting to use our models and ways of working because they know it came from 65,000 years of knowledge and strength and has been built with deep wisdom and connection with the world. They know they are missing out on something. This is all ours. So this was an invitation to see our community and our world from our eyes, totally. People were invited to do artwork, poetry, all sorts of creative ways in order to express that. And you'll see some of those things in the reports that are online. It was a starting point really to look at finding a central point where our lens was the main lens, and to provide hope.
Heard from a number of Aboriginal innovators and thinkers who are really championing Aboriginal ways of valuing and Aboriginal knowledges as ways to address contemporary challenges, and not just for Aboriginal people. So we heard about Bruce Pascoe, who has been learning or relearning about Aboriginal agriculture and developing new kinds of grain.
This is the start of a real Australian agriculture, because many of these grains, and Decompositum is one of them, grows on sand, needs one watering only. This is the threshold of a new agriculture in Australia, in a country where water shortage is going to get worse.
We heard from Victor Stephenson, who's been using Aboriginal knowledge of Aboriginal cultural burning practices to address fire in Australia.
The country was well managed and there was a lot of grasslands and healthy landscapes, and that was important because animals depend on the grasses and the grasses are there for seeds and food.
When the settlers came to Australia, it changed immediately by taking fire out of the landscape completely. And so what was going on for thousands of years of people looking after the land, suddenly it just stopped.
And we heard from Tyson Yonker Porter, who has in his book Sand Talk, really, which is subtitled How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World, talks about the importance of this knowledge to all peoples, and to do that has created the Indigenous Knowledge Lab in Deakin University.
Our cultures are adaptive in this way. They always have been. But what is the nature of that adaptivity? Because it's something we're going to need coming into this Anthropocene. We need, and people are calling for, a new way of being, as if this is something that we can design and that will emerge, and that we can then freeze that system in place again and try and keep as much as as much of this as possible. But what we're really looking at is having to develop, to co-evolve cultures of transition during a period of transition that is going to last for quite a while, centuries.
So I think we can see from this exploration that Aboriginal-led social innovation can take many different forms. There are some big fundamental injustices that need to be addressed. So that's one area where people are focusing. The Uluru Statement from the Heart is about the representation of Aboriginal people, and it's about truth-telling and it's about reconciliation. Similarly, I think Daryl Rigney's work and Njurundjeri people's work around nation building is about how do we organise as a people. That's a pretty fundamental thing. And then at the same time, we're seeing Aboriginal innovators lead innovations like the Koori Caucus and their work on creating the Koori justice system in Victoria. So Aboriginal-specific innovations that create better outcomes for Aboriginal people. And then we see people like Dana Shen talking about what she calls Nunga streaming, this idea that actually if we design our services and policies and responses for Aboriginal people first and foremost, hey, we might get something that works much better for everybody because it will be designed on a very different basis from the industrialized culture in which we live in. And then we heard from Bruce Pascoe and Victor Stephenson and Tyson Yonker Porter and they're representative of a number of Indigenous thinkers and innovators and saying, what I always find an incredibly generous offering, they're saying, hey, we know some stuff. We've been here a long time. We know how to live with this country. We have ways of thinking and organizing that are inherently about complexity and working through complexity. And hey, industrialized peoples, you need to work through this shit. And we might have something that can help you with that. So let's work together on that. And I always find that a particularly moving offering. And I think something where there is a real potential to build a new way of being in Australia and a new kind of innovation and different kinds of futures that bring together some very different worldviews.
My name's Vicky Charles. Lots of people here in Adelaide call me Aunty Vicky. I'm an Alara Mara woman from the Northern Territory who, due to white policy, grew up. I was removed from my mother and grew up in Adelaide. From the age of 2 months, and I have a long, vast working career, and you know, I could talk forever about that, but I won't. How I cope with a lot of stuff is I feel like I do that bit of explosion or I shut down, so I'm either really heightened or I just close off and, you know, want to go and sit in the corner and just be by myself. Most of the time, if I explode, I feel like Taxi as an organisation are really responsive in the respect of I will explode and say I have to go, you know, and go and sit in the park or whatever, and you guys are really good about that. You're not thinking that I'm just gone off and sitting in the park for the sake of sitting in the park. So I think your cultural understanding is a lot better than a lot of other places when we when I talk about how I look after myself. The main way I look after myself when I with anything to do with work is about family.
Yeah.
So I go and, you know, hang with my grandkids or, you know, go home and talk to the boys or my boys or, you know, it's about that family connection which brings me back.
If we were to have a new Aboriginal member of staff here, like what would you advise them in terms of how to look after themselves?
I always find that this question, sort of that question, hard because not everyone's like me.
Yeah.
and say, as another, if another Aboriginal person came on board, I'd certainly obviously try to get to know them as well, and offer my services for cultural supervision if they felt that they needed that.
Mm.
Having cultural supervision is really important to be able to have a bitch and whinge about something, or to be able to...
Of course, to as always on our cultural journey at TACSI, Aunty Vicky Charles has been there for us, and we've met her a number of times through FINSI, and in the episode Being a Social Innovator, we explored... how to deal with the different emotional labours that one might experience as a social innovator. And Aunty Vicky here is talking about that from an Aboriginal person's perspective. And she talks to us about some of the things that can make social innovation work culturally unsafe for Aboriginal people. And also, importantly, some of the things that... non-Aboriginal people can do to act in allyship and create safer cultural spaces. In the episode Creating Social Outcomes, we heard from another Aboriginal innovator, Clinton Schultz, who was part of a team that created the Aboriginal Social and Emotional Wellbeing Framework. So that provides a framework for how we can think about wellbeing for different Aboriginal groups, and captures, I think, some things that you wouldn't expect to see in a non-Indigenous model of wellbeing, but perhaps should.
So the best way for you guys to wrap your heads around this thing is to think of it like a wheel. Lay it out exactly like the wheel on your car. So at the center there, you've got your hub or your nuts. That hold. So connection to physical well-being. As an Aboriginal man, as a Gamilaroi man, when I think of physical well-being, yes, I'm considering all those elements of physical health and well-being that we'd usually consider. Nutrition, healthy lifestyle, you know, not being exposed to chronic disease, etc., etc. All those elements. But also when I'm thinking about physical well-being from an Aboriginal perspective, I'm thinking of it as the body is a vessel. So that connection of body to spirit is also very important. So beyond all the psychological and emotional factors that we generally think of in terms of mental and emotional well-being, once again, as a Gamilaroi man, when I'm talking about connection to my emotional or my mental state, I'm talking about my ability to just sit and be at peace with my thoughts. So if I'm at unease at any stage, there'll be certain places that I can go where I can just sit and I can listen to what's going on around me. It might be my ancestors talking to me, it might be the birds, it could just be the trees. I can process all that information. Now, if I was to lose that ability, that would lead to quite a lot of instability for me, because it's an important part. The community. So when we're considering community, once again, it's one of these terms that can have many different meanings when you're talking to Aboriginal people. So I could be talking about my geographic community. So I'm a member of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community on the Gold Coast, because that's where I live. I could be talking about my heritage community. So I'm a Gamilaroi man, so I could be talking about that community. I could be using it in a generalised term to talk when I'm talking about engaging with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So I might just be saying, yeah, I've got to go have a yarn to community. What I'm actually saying is I've just got to go have a yarn with Aboriginal. So culture, generally when we're talking about culture, people consider things like language. Language is obviously the most important part of most people's culture. But also law for us, so L-O-R-E. Everybody would have heard L-O-R-E, law. Aboriginal concept of law, which is vastly different to LAW. Our law is based on ancient principles of respect and understanding, and it's been unchanged since the beginning of time, so everybody's aware of what it is. And connection to land or connection to country. You'll also hear people use the words connection to nature or connection to environment in there, particularly people who unfortunately have been removed and haven't had the opportunity or the chance to get back to country, to meet their mob or to engage with their peoples. So that you'll find... And then connection to spirituality and ancestors. And this is a section that sometimes raises some concerns for people because they go, oh, spirituality. So when people try and label what spirituality should be sometimes, for me and for many other peoples who work in this area, spirituality is just a set of beliefs and a set of principles that people are guided by and believe in. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, our beliefs in the dreaming or people's beliefs in the Bible and Christianity or even people's steadfast belief in science. It's a set of beliefs, it's a set of principles, it's a set of them, of ways they understand themselves.
And in that same episode, we heard from Sherry Carney about the Interplay Framework, work that she'd been doing with remote Aboriginal communities to translate between worldviews, I guess is one way to think about it, to show that actually if you focus on the kinds of outcomes that are important for Aboriginal people around culture and language, for example, you also get the kinds of outcomes that non-Indigenous government cares about, for example, learning English and maths. And I think this bridging function is a very important one for non-Indigenous social innovators to provide that bridge between Indigenous and non-Indigenous worldviews.
When we looked at our data, we found that it supported what community said. It showed that culture, empowerment and community are in fact stepping stones to achieve success in education, employment and health. Let's look at education, for example. Now, language is key in remote communities. Many languages have been lost, but many are very much alive. Some Aboriginal people speak four or five different languages as well as English. But Aboriginal language speakers have very little chance to learn their own language at school. Our analysis showed that Aboriginal students who learn about their own culture at school and first learn literacy in their own language, so Aboriginal literacy, do better at English literacy and numeracy. That is, education outcomes are better for those who learn Aboriginal literacy as a stepping stone to English literacy.
In our modules about systems thinking, we kept returning to the idea that Indigenous ways of thinking, Indigenous knowledge systems, are inherently systemic. And we heard that from non-Indigenous systems thinkers like Peter Senge as much as we did from Indigenous systems thinkers themselves. And here's a snippet of a conversation between Tyson Yonker-Porter and Melanie Goodchild of the Turtle Island Institute.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, that's why maybe it's difficult sometimes for folks to recognize they're part of systems, and because it sounds like something external to us, like, you know, the system let us down, we need to change the system, as if it has a life of its own, when really we're embedded in those relationships, we're a part of them. And I think about, you know, when you were just mentioning language, when I was first studying systems, it was through social and ecological sustainability. I was studying resilience thinking, complexity and systems, you know, what we call complex social ecological adaptive systems.
Right.
And I kept hearing words like wilderness, nature, ecology, environment. And I thought, gee. And so I texted an elder back home, Albert Hunter in Manitou Rapids, back in Treaty 3, back home in the north where I come from. And I said, I've never heard anyone say in our language, Anishinaabe, when, like, I've never heard anything translated as nature. And he said, no, we say Gidakimanan, and it means everything. Everything in creation, the sun, the moon, the stars, the trees, the water, mountains, and your sacred place in creation. He said, we just say everything. So there is no separation. And like you said, there's sort of an abstraction of nature, and that disconnect is fueled by the language of the colonizer in terms of English. It really predisposes us in some ways to an anthropocentric bias. This is sort of what I've come to realize, you know, there's things, they're nouns, they're an it. Mm. How can you think of the wind as a relative if it's a thing, or the earth herself, or the sun?
Yeah.
And so it's a beautiful multi-layered lessons in our languages.
Well, even our technologies, you know, these are not separate from those things. You know, there's no concept of a synthetic, you know, thing that you might make, because these things are part of nature as well. that isn't even nature, it's everything. But you know, you follow those patterns of creation in the making, and then the entire life cycle of an object that you might make, or a technology, or you know, a network of technologies that are sitting within an economy that's also embedded within that landscape, you know, which is you, which is culture, which is land, which is creation, and everything, spirit right through, you know. So this idea of there being a technology, and then there being there being a nature, and then there being technology is this thing that's kind of separate from nature as well, in the same way that something abstract like society is separate from nature. And you know, it's a bit terrifying, isn't it, the idea that you have to separate in order to have one of these civilizations.
And in the module Acting in Systems, we heard about the process for working with Indigenous knowledge that Tyson Yonker Porter describes in his book Sand Talk.
What we had found was a broad, common description of Indigenous ways of valuing, ways of being, ways of knowing, and ways of doing. These things had a widespread order, a sequence in all cultural activities in which people were sharing or producing knowledge on country. We had our own personal metaphors for describing this process of induction. I referred to it as spirit, heart, head, and hands. Mama Doris knew it as respect, connect, reflect, direct. She insisted on that order. She also noted that non-Aboriginal people seemed to work through the same steps, but in reverse. Mama Doris has observed interventions and programs imposed on her community for over half a century, noticing that they always begin with the last step, direct. Government agents come into the community with a plan for change, and they direct activities toward this change immediately. When it all fails, they go backward to the next step, reflect. They gather data and measure outcomes and try to figure out what went wrong. Then they realize they didn't form relationships with the community, so belatedly they go to the next step, connect. Through these relationships, they discover the final step, which should have been the first, finding a profound respect for members of the community they ruined. They cry as they say farewell and return to the city, calling, "Thank you, I've learned so much from you." Invert that process, and you'll have something approximating an appropriate way of coming to Indigenous knowledge and working towards sustainable solutions.
In the module that explored the innovation journey and the importance of imagination and invention, we heard once again from Arnie Vicky about the work we did to adapt Family by Family to work better for Aboriginal families and the process that we went through to get there, and the importance of having an Aboriginal person lead that work.
Is something where we really fell short in those original prototypes around interactions was with working with Aboriginal families. And I think, again, that's where the rubber hit the road in Playford, where we learned that even some of that original thinking around interactions needed to be adapted for Aboriginal contexts. And Playford gave us that opportunity to start thinking about that. And that's how Arnie Vicky came to us.
From the report, there was a gap, and that part, I guess one of the recommendations from that gap was about employing an Aboriginal person to be the conduit or the community connector, which is what we were called, which was what I was called in the end, to be able to open doors, I guess, and get access to Aboriginal members in the community.
What was it like coming into Family by Family at that time?
So I'd already known Taxi, and I was like, oh, this place looks amazing. And I kept thinking of Google at the time, because that's what it reminded me. Whenever you looked at anything on Google, there was all these, it was bright and colourful and all these wonderful things happening. And, you know, that was at a time.
When it came to learning about participation, we looked at the process used to develop the Uluru Treaty and the care that was put into this participatory and deliberative process. And here I am reading from The Long Road to Uluru by Professor Megan Davis. As a first step, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander members of the Council sought advice from leaders and traditional owners on the form of the dialogue to be adopted in each region. The dialogue would be a structured and deliberative decision-making process that involved intensive civics education, an explanation of the legal options that the Prime Minister and opposition leader had given us permission to consult on, and a preference matrix that would enable communities to assess reform proposals and rank them according to the interests of the region. Each of the constitutional dialogues was run in precisely the same way and took place over a three-day weekend to accommodate participants' employment. The method was a structured, deliberative decision-making process that engaged participants in a dialogue. The decision to have a dialogue was deliberate. We were conducting our work in communities exhausted by the superficial consultation practices of the bureaucracy, particularly the Commonwealth bureaucracy. The tolerance for any process that looked top-down or tick-a-box was very low. We took very seriously the importance of the process being bottom-up, driven by the people themselves. 60% of the participants had to be drawn from First Nations traditional owners, 20% from local Aboriginal community organisations, and 20% from Indigenous leaders such as elders, stolen generations, and significant figures in the struggle. It was important to us, for the legitimacy of the process, that the decision-making was led by the cultural authority of the country, the traditional owners of the First Nations.
I think everybody's favourite Finzi episode just might be the one that doesn't really feature me. This is the conversation between Dana Shen and Auntie Vicky exploring what it means to do co-design well with Aboriginal people and how to have further self-determination. And this is a little bit of Dana talking about the principles for co-design with Aboriginal people that she developed with Aboriginal people through a co-design process.
No, that's good, Ard. I can actually sort of build, sort of add to it a bit. Like, I really appreciated the way you spoke about our peoples and understanding of complex systems. Because actually, it's how we think all the time.
Yes.
So, you know, when services are created, they're often focused on individuals. And actually, we think about the family systems.
Yes.
You know, we think about, you know, when we're thinking about a child, we're thinking about the child and their parents. And then we're thinking about the aunties and the uncles. And then we're thinking about their connections. And then we're thinking about their connections, which becomes community.
Yeah.
And that's really important, because we know, at least for our communities, and we think it's beneficial for others too, is that if we can take a broader systemic look at all parts and support all parts of those things, the likelihood of supporting a child and a family in that is much better.
Mm.
And that's a systemic, that's a systems approach, that's systems thinking. And similarly, I also find that with our communities, if we give them the chance and listen to what they say, they actually know how to analyse complex social systems. And I think that comes from lots of things. I think it comes from our own traditional knowledges and how we see the world. You know, it's that we are in ecosystems, you know. We are connected to our country. We're not separate from country. We're part of country. Mm. You know, all of those things make us a part of something bigger. And I believe that, plus the trauma we've been put through, so the hurts we've been put through, and our understanding of how
systems can hurt people. I think that's given us the ability to be able to look at things and go, ah, I know what's really going on here.
Mm.
You're saying that, but actually this is what's really going on. Like, so the ability to uncover the truth of behaviours in a system, to call it out for what it is amazing and powerful. Like, I've heard so many times our people just call things out and go, oh, hang on a second, I know you're calling it that word, but this is what it really is.
Yeah.
So there's something about all of our history and what we've had to go through that's helped us to kind of uncover those things.
Yeah.
So, Anne, I wondered if I could maybe take the next step. You were talking about the importance of principles in this work. And
yeah.
So I thought what I would do is just talk a bit about what had come out of the child and family support system co-design. I just thought, and maybe just talk through it a bit with Anne as well. So a key element that was done very fairly early on in the process was around the design of co-design principles. We had a senior Aboriginal woman that had put that forward as a really important thing, to be really clear about that. And that was taken and that was listened to and it was developed. And it was developed from the words of what people decided was the best. So I thought I would just touch on a couple of these and maybe talk a bit more about what that might mean in the process of co-design. So the co-design process, this is principle one, recognises the history and wisdom of Aboriginal peoples and will work to create Aboriginal-led systems and services that support self-determination and safeguards these approaches. So I'll just sort of unpack that. What does that mean for co-design? What does that mean for working with to make something better? Mm. In the Aboriginal context, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander context, we are trying to recognise history and wisdom. So what we have as a peoples, the connection with land, our cultures, our language, our nation, but also the history of colonisation, the truth of that and how it's hurt our people and how we've survived. All of that will be thought about in the process of design. We want to work towards Aboriginal-led. And this is really important because, and Aunty Vicky and I, you know, both know this, for us to really crack some of the most difficult things, in what happens in our communities, we can't only rely on mainstream. When I call the word mainstream, I mean systems that are for everybody, not specifically for Aboriginal people. We can't rely on those only to make a difference for us, because it is our own peoples that have the skill and the expertise to actually do the things we do and to understand what is required to reduce pain and to help healing in our communities. It's us. It's in us to be able to do that. So anything we can do in a design process, and that is the way you workshop something, the way you write something, the way you translate something, the way you walk alongside, all of that is about how can we ensure that we are working towards building that process of building that process, that way of working that is about giving power, actually. Mm. And I want to talk a bit about power. This is something that I've started to think a lot about, what that means for our peoples, to determine for themselves. Now, having said that, and I'll come to the next one in a moment, I'll just take one more of these ones, more sort of stuff around our peoples, and then talk about allies. Allies are required. And it goes back to what you said, Aunt. We didn't get ourselves here in this way. Something happened called colonization. And then the subsequent policies that occurred after that. Now, to extricate that, to change that, that damage, and to rebuild our communities, most of that we can do. We can do with the right support from allies. So I'll come back to that in a moment, because that particular principle, I imagine, will be really important for listeners about what they're thinking and how they can work. So I just want to talk about one more, and that is around diversity. So Aunty Vicky talked a bit about that, our different voices and who we are. The co-design process will ensure and give status to the diverse voices, knowledge, experiences, skills, and perspectives of Aboriginal nations, communities, families, and individuals, acknowledging the intergenerational and complex traumas experienced in the community, and this is important, the hopes and strengths of communities. So if I sort of break that down and we use that as a, think about this as a set of lenses, I suppose, coloured lenses that we can look through as we're thinking about an intervention, or actually I don't like that word, I won't use that again. A lot of our peoples don't like the word intervention. A service or a response that helps, something like that. There's a few things to think about. The first of all, the importance of diverse voices. This is such an interesting thing to talk about, so I hope that I don't lose people along the way, the listeners that are listening right now on this. We are such a diverse peoples, and our diversity comes from our traditional cultural connections, where we come from, our language, our land, our totems, our connections. So they're unique. On that, we also have had colonization that's impacted us and had such variable impacts for all of us. You know, some of our peoples didn't see colonizers as early as others, and that had an impact on what they hold now and understand and have as culture compared to a lot of our communities. Mm-hmm. We also have our peoples that were stolen, like policies were put in place that took them from the strongest things for them, and that was language and culture and our own families. And they have their own identities. You know, I remember listening to a person speaking about his experience of being in the stolen generation, and he talked about feeling quite different. And I knew that in theoretically, of course I knew that, but I didn't know it in my heart until I heard the way he spoke about it. Mm. And you know, he when you hear those stories, you hear a story of loss, you hear a story of missed things. But also I heard this amazing countryman, one of my countrymen, speak about his experience of the stolen generation. And he talked about that whilst he didn't have the lived experience of being a Ngurrindjeri person on Ngurrindjeri land, he had the felt experience of that. He knew that his connection to our people and our land, that was real, and he felt that and he resonated with that. So already I've given you, the listeners, multiple diversities, and I haven't even gone into the depth of any of this. There's so many other things. But that's why it's so important to, when you're thinking about co-design and when you're thinking about working with our peoples, that that you take time and you give space and you give a breadth of approaches to listen to people, because it is so different what you will hear, and all of those voices really matter. So I think that's a really important thing to understand. And finally, I just wanted to, for that particular co-design principle, I just wanted to highlight the intergenerational and complex traumas with hopes and strengths. So if you want to do this work with our people, if you want to walk alongside our people and truly be allies, a couple of things are important for you to think about. First of all, it is about personal responsibility and the responsibility you take on this. It's not about waiting for someone to give you cultural awareness training. Mm. And sitting back and waiting for somebody to rock up and tell you what to do. Actually, you can be very respectfully curious and gently try to learn about the communities you're working with and where you live. That's your responsibility if you want to really do this. So that's one thing that's really important. The second thing is this. Our communities are going through a lot of pain. And, you know, you see it all the time, you know, the data, closing the gap isn't working, children in out of home care, people are dying, there is a lot of suffering And this is really, really important, there is a lot of strength and there is a lot of winning and there's a lot of, you know, people doing incredibly well, you know, in our communities and finding a way to get through this and thriving and finding humour and joy in this. So it's important as an ally to carry both at the same time and to remember that both are there. That will help you to work with our communities if you can hold both. And then finally, before I hand back to Aunt, I just wanted to talk about what it means to think about being an ally in all this. And I hope this is helpful, you know, just to give a sense of what it means to have an identity, you know, in this work. You are really important. So I know I'm potentially speaking to Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, to Aboriginal people, you know, our sisters and brothers. I give my respects here to you if you happen to be listening to this. I know that you have cultural authority too. So I hope this is resonating with you. For non-Aboriginal people, non-Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that are hearing this, some things to consider. In this process, Aboriginal people, so the process of co-design, will be supported by co-design allies. Allies are non-Aboriginal people that will work alongside in the co-design process. Allies will, throughout the co-design process and within their power, so that's back to that power word again, work to support the self-determination of Aboriginal people in the co-design process and in true partnership. So this is a deep willingness to really work in partnership with people. Ensure they deeply listen and learn and seek guidance and direction on the right protocol and ways of working. So you're going to listen to people like Auntie Vicky when she says something to you, and because she's kind and warm, she's going to say it in a particular type of way, which will be really polite and respectful to you, but it's really important that you listen to exactly what she is saying to you. Ensure they are self-reflecting and building their cultural fitness and responsiveness and practicing cultural humility and respect. Really important, strong word that came out of the co-design process from people. You're practicing a humility, you know. You are seeing the status and importance of Aboriginal business and words. You're thinking, hey, I don't know everything. Actually, I can be open and learn from somebody else. That's humility. And you can do that in this context. And this is really important. So there's listening and there's working towards particular goals. But it's really, really important to think about these things too. You want to work with Aboriginal people to translate their vision. So not your vision, what's their vision into the systemic design and challenge the barriers to this, including systemic racism and individual and organisational white privilege. So what does that mean? It means that you need to be self-reflective. You need to be reflecting on your own biases. How does your actions and the way that you do things, the way you say things, reinforce systems that get in the way of this? And you change that. That's the responsibility, but it's the wonder. Because if we can do these things together, we can truly make some changes. So for the listeners out there, I hope that's helpful. I'll hand back to Ad.
In the last episode of Finzi before this one, we explored what the future might be like if we embrace social innovation. And I think a big part of that in Australia will be creating new spaces for Aboriginal-led innovation and for innovation between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples. And you might remember this, my son reporting in 2040 from the Ghana Future Lab, based on an idea again by Tyson Yonker-Porter of Indigenous Knowledge Labs across Australia. 3D Radio. G'day, this is 3D Radio and I'm Ivor Steele-Vanstone on Ghana Yurta in the year 2040. On the Youth Show today, we're reviewing 10 years of social progress in South Australia as part of the 20th year of the Festival of Life here from the Garner Knowledge Lab in the Botanical Gardens, which for the last 30 years has been bringing 60,000 years of knowledge into the mainstream. New ways of living, new ways of doing. Radio. So back in 2021, I think there is a bit of a shift happening in Australia and an increased interest in building Indigenous ways of knowing and being and doing into projects. We've certainly been seeing that in our work at TACSI, and I'm not sure we would have seen that a few years ago. And I think an interest in from the general public about reconciliation or conciliation with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And I think social innovation has a special role to play in this. I think we found ourselves in some quite interesting and sometimes surprising places helping Aboriginal organisations bridge into white systems where they wanted to do that, but also helping non-Indigenous organisations build their capability and confidence to educate themselves about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and country, and to take their first steps to considering and engaging Aboriginal voice to shape the services and the policies that they develop as organisations. And I think because as social innovators, or certainly the work we do at TACSI, we're so often there at the start of things that we can build in at that very start a different power dynamic, a different way of doing and being, and ways of working that are genuinely respectful and supportive and further self-determination.